Gather your seat. Gary, if you want to grab the... if you filled in a sign-in sheet, you're eligible. If you didn't, you're not. Must be present to win.
Yes.
Always. Can you get that okay? Yeah, I guess so.
Sometimes.
For those of you on the internet, if you were here, you would have an opportunity to win. Let's get Frank to do the drawing. We have a total of five prizes. Tonight, the first three are from Opus 4 Studios, and they are an awesome carry bag from various places at the Infocom. Was it Infocom convention you went to, Mike? What is all this from?
NAB.
All right. NAB, National Association of Broadcasters. So there's a water bottle with a lovely stopper with a hanger on it, and or a way to hang it, and a beautiful bag. So Frank is going to pick the first winner, who is Gary Reed's?
JJ.
JJ. Where art thou? Okay. So JJ wants to pass this along here. Okay, I'm going to put it here and JJ can pass it up. Let's do the next one. Bob Randolph. Hooray! He's here, he wins. Okay, and the third one, which I believe is the best one, because it's red. And the top winner is...
It's Dr. Mike.
Dr. Mike doesn't win because he's giving them away, so... Yeah. That doesn't mean you're not a winner, Mike, but you don't win this. And that is, here, let me get in the light. Mary Marins? Let me look at it. I think it is. So Mary Marins, Scott, are you still here? Okay. So while you're waiting, if you noticed on that crawl of the previous honorary member winners, Leonard Bernstein won, Eugene Ormandy won, Chet Atkins won.
Dave Ewer, Ewes?
Dave? All righty. Congratulations. Walt Disney was a winner of that award. And many other people as well. Okay, we have two more prizes, and these are copies of the audio and video tribute that Bob Smith and I did for Frank when he won the Honorary Member Award, with many of the pictures that you see here, plus pictures of albums that are included with the music that's in this.
Dave Campbell.
Dave Campbell. Yay, congratulations.
One more?
And one more.
Okay, last one.
Not available in any stores.
Yes.
Brian Hubert?
Yay, all right. I don't have to reach very far. Congratulations. Okay, so let's get settled in here, and we'll go back on the stage. I'm going to get... While I'm getting Frank settled here, there were some questions from the internet asked of you. And let's get the phones on you here first so you can hear.
We didn't have too many.
Yeah. Pardon me? Didn't have too many prizes?
Phones.
Oh, phones? Yeah, well, that's enough. There was some questions on the internet, and Lars, help me if I don't remember them. One was that somebody had seen a lot of pictures of Columbia Studios recording sessions, and they were using a lot of RCA BX44s. Is that the right number?
Yeah.
And yet the pictures that we have show a lot of M49s, Neumann M49s. So,
yeah, well, the 44s were a standard microphone used almost entirely, 44 or 60, RCA 67.
And let me, while your aunts keep talking, and off, here's one, here's a 49 right here.
Yeah.
Dan? Yeah. Ah, for crying out loud. Push the menu button, Gary, which is, I think, the right-hand one there, and then scroll, push the down button, and no, it's not that one, so go back up. Sorry that the tracking on this projector is screwing up for some reason. It's been working all day. So go sideways now, display, go down, tracking the second one, and just go off of zero. That's what I did the last time. Yeah, okay. So then go back up.
You want to go back to zero?
No, just leave it as it is. It's fine. Okay, and then that'll fade out as you if you leave it alone. Okay, so this microphone on the left here is an M49. And you use this microphone a lot.
I did.
Yeah, why?
Because I love the sound of it.
Okay.
Made the vocals sound good too.
Yeah.
So,
did you use it only on vocals or on other things?
On other things. But I was pretty much, well, I wouldn't say criticized, but my fellow engineers kept saying, why do you always use that same microphone? Well, because I like what I get with it.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, I marked the numbers on the mic.
Yeah, and actually, I got some slides later here that we'll look at to see that part. There was another question that I forget. Lars? And Matt had one that... Somebody.
Yeah, a couple of them. One is Chuck Renata, who produces Nancy Sinatra's radio show.
Oh, Chuck Renata?
Granata. N-A-T-A.
Do you remember Chuck Granata? Yeah.
He just gives you his best. He wishes that he could be online listening tonight, but he's tied up and can't.
Oh, he sent his best to you. He heard we were doing this, and he said to say hello.
I haven't seen him probably 50 years.
Wow. All right.
And then the question that I had, too, is could you talk a little bit about the fact that, from what I gather, you didn't actually mix the final mixes, but you just sent the tapes off somewhere else and they were handled?
Well,
let me repeat that for the internet people. The question is about the process of recording, and did Frank actually mix the tunes, or did he send the tapes off somewhere else to do something, be done, have something done to them? Okay, go ahead, Frank.
No, the truth was that I wanted to continue from start to finish, but it became a problem because I was doing so many studio live dates. Kept taking me off and putting someone else in, and then I would go follow up again, so that it was difficult.
Mm-hmm. Now, your career, as Dave Simons has pointed out, you were the only guy, the only recording engineer to go from recording on wax discs to digital 24 track.
Yes.
And so things evolved quite a bit during the course of your career. Early on, you were recording mono, yes. single track, right? Then yes. you went to two track?
Two track.
And then you went to three track.
Then four,
uh-huh.
which we didn't do much of.
Mm-hmm. So when you were recording mono or even two track, the mix that was gotten, that was later issued on the record, was yours.
Yes.
There was not really much you can do downstream
no.
in the factory, in the process, with a single track. But as you started getting more tracks, what happened? As you started recording onto more tracks?
Well, then I would not be available to remix. Someone else was assigned to it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I knew who it was, I would just walk in and listen and offer some suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
I did that a number of times.
Yeah, and previously you've described the multi-track years as being more like a factory where everybody at each layer had a specific job to do. So the studio person, control man, I put control man in the title of this was because that was what they called themselves and each other in those days was control man, not engineer, but control man. The control man was responsible for getting the sound from the air onto the tape.
Yes.
And you would do some reverb things, perhaps,
yes.
or put your reverb on a second track or
yes.
something, or third track, and then send it on. And from there on, the control man wouldn't know what was done to it. Did the record ever get issued? Did it not get issued? Was it in a part of a compilation? Did this session get combined with that session, combined with that session? Or was it another session, some other further mixture? So it was not quite a sausage factory, but it was definitely a compartmentalized world where everybody had a specific role to do. So that's pretty much the answer to that question. But again, it evolved over time. At the beginning, he did a lot. What you heard on the radio was what Frank did. And then later, who knows? And in the case of Frank Sinatra, you recorded a number of things with him, but New York, New York in particular is one that's
yes.
that's well known. And he did most of his work out on the West Coast after a certain point in his career, but he came back to the East Coast to work with you and work in the 30th Street studio. And you did the sessions that resulted in New York, New York.
But also, there was trouble ahead of Mitch Hurd that Sinatra was in 30th Street because everyone was forbidden to record in 30th Street.
Only Columbia, CBS people.
Yeah.
But you've told us before at other meetings that there was some moonlighting going on.
Oh, yes.
Right? And what was the... I think Dave was there. Dave Simons was there when you were talking with Mitch. Tell us that story. Can you... Sinatra.
And in New York, New York?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he was down there with Frank at 30th Street. Previous to that, Sinatra, who had recorded in New York since he left Columbia in 1953, I believe came back and worked with Frank Blanco on the Strikeholds album. And like Frank, that was around 1958, about 10 years earlier. And then it was a full 10 years later in 79, he wanted to go back to the 30th Street studio, and he met up with Frank once again. Who I believe, according to Granada there, Sinatra referred to Frank Lake as Teach.
Teach?
Yes.
T-E-A-C-H?
Huh. Yeah.
Cheech. Cheech. Oh.
Cheech.
Right. That's that Italian?
Italian endearment.
Right, right.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
So, and then they cut the, it was while he was there, and I believe it was fall of 1979, that they cut a couple masters of being from New York, New York. And there's some mystery, and they did go back to L.A. and do some more recutting, and there's a little mystery as to which one they used, but we've decided that he used the one from 30, like Frank.
And then how did Mitch find out about that?
Well, Mitch, you know, of course, by this time, Mitch had not been on the scene for the 14 years, so he left in 65.
Right.
And
Frank said, you told him yourself?
Yes.
Okay. Afterwards?
Yeah, and Frank.
What?
Go ahead, Dave.
Frank and I were driving, this is now in 2003, we were driving down from Frank's house when he lived in Westchester. We were driving to Mitch's place to interview Mitch as part of the book I was writing, and I said to Frank, did Mitch ever know about Frank, about Sinatra coming back to 30th Street? And Frank, Lato, said, I don't think he does. And I said, well, are we going to tell him? Are you going to tell him? And he said, sure. So this is about 2 hours into our conversation that we're having up there. It's his place at Central Park West, three of us, and that was the subject turned to Sinatra. And then Frank said, well, you didn't know, right, Frank, that he had been coming, he'd come back and to do some recording with us there. And at that point, Mitch said, you're kidding! And he wasn't mad or anything. It was, you know, water under the bridge. And he said, I did not know that until now. So it's good. So Frank had told him right there at that point. And that was a moment I will never forget, being part of that.
It was a difficult situation because I didn't want him to get so angry that he would resign. But as it turned out, he left on his own.
Yeah, and the secret was safe for, 20 years or something?
Yeah.
Right.
All right, well, let's continue on here with our meeting. The next thing we're going to do is watch another video in the 30th Street studio of Tony Bennett singing a Harold Arlen, Dory Previn Langdon song called, what is it? I forget what it's called, but we're going to watch it anyway. So long, big time. I think we're going to watch it.
I didn't recognize the title of the tune.
Right. As if you were doing what you used to do, like this.
And I'm just going to pause for a second here and point out that this, the top of his head and nose that we're seeing is our friend Frank here, who was in fact Tony Bennett's engineer for 42 years or something.
You know,
right.
With your hand.
I never caught up.
Or think of that picture. I think of
right.
Well,
it's a lot.
Bright lights are dimmer. Bankroll is slimmer. Looks like I'm down and done. Bye bye. I gotta run. Bye bye. Nah. lost it on the cards and the ponies. Tell the friends and fair weather ponies living high. Tell them bye. So I'll rush off and try a new routine. I'm a guy who rolls with the punches and my hunches. It's time to quit the scene. Tell the kids and tell all the cookies. Tell the babes and tell all the bookies that I knew that I'm through. You do my new tears for me. Tell them no tears for me. So long, so long, big time. Big door, bright lights, big time. I won't pretend I am glad.
Song or what? That is from a DVD that's a tribute to Harold Arlen. And Harold Arlen wrote some amazing. He was the composer, and other people did the lyrics. They were the lyricists, and he did some amazing songs that you would recognize hundreds of.
Yes.
And that DVD is available, and I'll tell you later about it. But it's wonderful. It's all different people singing stuff. And Tony Bennett. I mean, what a what a way to sell a song. So what was working with Tony like? You'd worked with him for an awful long time.
Wasn't any problem at all. We got along beautifully. And I think that was true also because our family backgrounds were very similar. Both our parents were aliens. They came to this country.
From Italy? From Italy?
From Italy.
Yeah.
With the idea that they wanted to start a happy family. Good children. And Mom did all of that.
Mm-hmm. Were your families about the same size? How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I had one sister and five brothers.
Was he about the same? Was his family about the same size? Maybe, Colette, do you know?
He had two sisters.
Two sisters,
yeah.
Okay. All right.
And one was his manager.
One sister was his manager?
Right.
Wow.
3 years until he became so popular that he had to get a full-time, another manager.
Wow.
To take care.
And did you work from him, or I'm sorry, did you work with him from the very start of his career, or he already had something going before Columbia got him?
No. I used to drive in and out of New York, so I put the radio on.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Martin Block and all kinds of people. Play the current records or those from I never.
Sure.
So I got to talk with him and discuss to.
Discuss various artists?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And Tony was one of them? All right. I got to tell you, we did a dry run here the other night, Saturday night, with Dave and Steve and Frank and I in this room, and it went really great with the technical stuff. This is reasonably complicated, what you're seeing here, and it's been an adventure getting it to work. And as I was driving away from here that night, on the radio comes on Boulevard of Broken Dreams by Tony Bennett, which the DJ said was his first recording. And I'm driving along, and I saw people looking up into the sky to the east, and there was this gigantic rainbow in the sky. So I figured having that experience with you three guys that night and then driving away listening to Tony Bennett and seeing this monstrous rainbow was auspicious, and it was pretty, that was a good evening. Well, we've got a Tony Bennett song here that we want to listen to from the album I Want to Be Around. And Dave, you picked this one, and this is called, this song is called If I Love Again. And tell us about this a little bit before we listen to it.
A couple of years after Frank and I had become made acquaintance, we were spending a lot of time together, and my wife and I would go down to Somers, New York, and have dinner that Claire would make these fantastic chicken piccata or something with this greatest twice boneless chicken breast I've ever had. Wonderful meal that she'd make. And we used to listen to a lot of the Tony stuff that Frank had recorded. And one particular night we got back, my wife pronounced this Frank's best track. And I said, really? She said, it is so beautiful. I listened to it few times. I'm like, yeah, I think she's got something here. And that day that we went to see Mitch, two of us, we were driving back, and I said, you know, Paula, my wife, Frank, she thinks this is possibly your biggest track. And I was blasting it, and Frank said, I think she's right.
All right.
But you have to agree with what my wife said anyway, because you like my wife.
And I got to tell you, Dave, since you're not here, when you were describing that meal that Colette fixed for you, she had the hugest smile on her face. So thank you. Bob, let's listen to If I Love Again.
If I love again, I'll find other charms. But I'll make believe you are in my arms.
And this picture is Frank and Colette, his wife, with Tony at some obviously swanky occasion. I don't know if you remember when that was.
It was at the Copacabana.
Oh, at the Copacabana?
He was appearing.
Wow.
Ringside seats for us. And,
wow. Oh, Colette, grab a microphone. You got to talk into it. Annette, would you grab it for and bring it over here? Great.
Tony was appearing at the Copa, and he invited Frank and I, and he had this big ringside table, and it was his mother and his sister, and it was wonderful because it was very family-oriented. And every time he would sing, and he'd sing toward his family, and just a big smile, and his mother was so proud of him. It was a wonderful evening, very special.
Oh, that's great. All right, thanks. I don't know if I had another picture. Oh, yeah, here's another picture of you listening with Tony. This is Tony over here for those in the audience. And this is Frank over here with a beard. Yeah. Yeah, actually there's a much less exotic story than then you might.
We were down at one of the islands.
Is it St. Thomas, I think he said?
St. Kitts or something? And he developed a rash. And Frank. He couldn't shave. So all the time we were down there, of course, his beard would keep growing. And by the time we got back, you know, he decided, well, let's try it. So he didn't shave for a while.
But I think he said it only lasted a month or something.
Well,
it didn't.
I was away, and I arrived by plane. And as I came off the plane, I approached Frank, and he didn't have a beard on. So I said, well, what happened to the beard? He said, I just wanted you to know that it was something special that you wanted me to have, but now it's over with.
It was special for you, and it's gone. Okay. Now, this shot here, we talked earlier about the M49s and how you would number them to be able to tell one from another. And here we see that this one is number 110. We earlier saw number 112 in the, I think it was the Glenn Gould video. And here's another shot of Johnny Mathis, also in 30th Street. And if I can get up there, that's number 110 also. How about that? So number 110 must have been your favorite mic or something.
At that time, yes.
Yeah. Did they change over time? Did individual mics change for you?
No, we must have had a dozen of.
Oh, yeah.
And so the ones I marked, I appreciated the response.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept using it.
Okay. And we've got another track here that you recorded from the Andy Williams Christmas album. It's a wonderful, or most wonderful time of the year. And Bob, go ahead and hit it.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. With the kids jingle belling and everyone telling you be of good cheer. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
You can hear that guy smiling when he's singing. Did you work at the beginning of his career? Did you record his first work, or did he come to you guys from somewhere else too?
Andy?
Yeah.
No, I told you earlier, Mitch refused to let anyone else record down there.
Other than Columbia Artists in the 30th Street studio, yeah.
So I ran into Andy Williams, and we were talking. And he said, you know, my contract is basically over with Cadence.
Cadence?
What do you think I should do? I said, you should do what you think is best, but you must keep in mind that whenever anyone else signs you, put out a release, Columbia will back them up. Just flood the market with Andy Williams records, which is what was done.
Well, he certainly became a big star. TV show and everything. TV shows.
Yeah. He was a nice fellow. Bland. That's why I didn't think his singing was that great.
Okay. Enough of him. You don't think that's a great song, though? You don't think that one was a great happy song?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So here's another shot of you in the studio. This is not the 30th Street studio, I think.
Studio B.
Studio B, yeah. And I don't know if there's anything more to say about that, but that's a shot of you. And here's another shot. Was that Kitty?
Kitty Callen.
Callen, right. Okay. She had a career for some time.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah.
She was married to Bob Thiel.
Oh.
Through this period.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had a couple of records with it that made some noise.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was asked to do
yeah.
a session. I said, sure.
Mm-hmm.
She was cute. She was a lot of fun.
This is you with
Bob Thompson. You know, he had been an employee at CBS, and he decided to go on his own. And he wanted to sign up some people. He said, oh, can you let me know when you're going to do more tunes with the people that no one knows?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, this was part of that.
Okay.
Never went anywhere.
Hmm. This is a close-up of the console in the 30th Street studio in the new control room era. And this is actually a still from the next video that we're going to see. There's a million knobs on this thing, and we're not seeing even all of it. There's a bunch more. Whoops, I keep triggering that up in the upper left corner here, but running all along there. How many inputs are on this thing now? We started with 12 on the old one. And this is like...
When I left, we were up to 24.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then it kept going. And I decided I can't do this kind of work.
Okay. Now we're going to watch another video, our final video for the night. This is from a movie of the making of the original cast recording of the Broadway show Company. And Stephen Sondheim was the lyricist, who you'll see. And this, again, is a 30th Street... I'm sorry, in the 30th Street console. And this is Fred at the beginning.
This number looks like number 6.
Moment, and then we'll talk further. All right, tracks 1, 2, and 3 have the 5 mic vocal split, right?
Yes. Drums is...
You've got 2 percussion men. You might as well put 1 group under the violins.
Yes.
No, wait a minute.
Make
the heaviest.
No,
you're either going to go under 4 or 5. Or, no, I don't want to listen. Just a minute. Who is this player?
Timpani.
You mean to tell me we have a timpanist, a legitimate drummer, and 2 percussion men? No.
No.
Impossible. Stand by, please. You could drive a person crazy. Take 1. I never heard it sound like this. It's wonderful. Yeah, we need more bass. There isn't any. I never heard that. That's nice. Yeah, the whole thing is very dotted. How fast can... And also, like, the juice of you, you're crazy. He's doing something, but I hardly hear it. The ending was great. Just a moment.
Tom.
Steve.
The good old ride is off.
Can we get some dynamics into it? Like, a person, what good about, and then when they do the doo-doo-doo-doos, get quiet, and then sing again, so that there's that...
Possible, except those doo-doos are high. It's very hard.
Yeah.
That's really a question of delicacy, not volume,
yeah.
Because you can't get Donna to sing that
all
soft,
right.
You know. Nobody can sing an A.
There's
soft.
Something so marvelously ludicrous about...
Yeah.
About,
I'll try to get them to make more contrast.
We're going to
Bobby. Let's hear you say it.
Booby.
That's it. Booby.
But when I sing it, it goes Bobby, baby, Bobby, booby, Bobby.
No, booby.
Bobby, baby, Bobby, booby, Bobby.
Booby.
Bobby, baby, Bobby, booby, Bobby.
Supposing you had to say goody, how would you say that, Bobby?
Goody.
Yeah. Bobby, baby, Bobby, goody.
Bobby, baby, Bobby, booby, Bobby.
That's it. That's it.
I
it's exactly
it,
the same vowel sound as good. Exactly the same vowel sound as good.
Booby, Bobby.
Booby. Booby. First lips. Booby. Bobby, booby.
Really? Bobby, baby, Bobby, booby, Bobby.
No, you're still doing it.
You can drive a person crazy.
The quality's nice.
You can drive a person mad. Do-do-do-do-do.
Great. Okay. The ladies who lunch, take one.
To disapprove another brilliant singer.
I'm going to pause this and say that we've edited this down to show you just the studio parts, and these original cast recording sessions would only happen one day a week. They could only happen on, I believe, Sundays, and they would start early in the morning and go until they were done. And that one, they wound up somewhere around 3 in the morning, and it was just not possible for this ultimate solo that you're going to hear a little bit of to occur. So it couldn't occur that night, and they came back and did it, and look who we see at the controls for this final session here. And where's the movie? Okay.
Great. That's one hell of a good take. I want you to come in and listen to it.
Perfect.
So that was a different studio than the original one. They recorded the orchestra and just...
Could I have one of those now?
Terry, no, more general question than that. It was,
sorry.
What should George Burt do? I wanted you to read
to
it.
To the movie, but I didn't cut it off, so we didn't want that. So they came back, and amazingly, there's Frank doing the mix, doing the overdub mix. So even though Fred did the other part, Frank finished it up. And you can see in this screenshot from the video that he's at a vastly different console. Those of you that are acquainted with consoles can see the faders there. And now we're entering into the era of Steve Epstein's expertise. This is... still 1970, so it's a little early, but this console was a different CBS custom-made console. And this one here, we figured out, was where, Steve? Not in 30th Street, but rather...
I think there's a Studio B at 4090 52nd Street. Does that sound right, Frank?
Does Studio B sound right? 52nd Street?
Yes.
Yeah, he says yes. So Frank did a lot of these kind of fill-in sessions as well as the ones that he was the sole engineer for. And I just want you to make note of these meters, this double meter bridge that looks like it's a mistake, but that is what it looks like, and we'll get back to it in a minute here. So next we're going to listen to, I think this is the last of our musical selections, Thelonious Monk, Straight No Chaser, which is another one that Frank did. So Bob? Those of you on the internet are kind of toughing it out, but those of us here in the room can hear how present and clear and right up front all of those instruments are in that huge room. And what was Thelonious like being with, and how did you get such a crystal clear sound on it?
He is such a nice man, unassuming. We come in, that night came in, took his hat off, set it down, and he had sheets of paper which he handed to the guys. And his theory was, give the musicians an idea of what they're going to have to do. And hear that. If it works, that's what we'll do. So that was his theory.
Mm-hmm. It worked.
Yeah, I never... I've had too much.
Okay.
But if, as it turned out, I had no idea about this tune, but no one told me anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I listened to the play while they were rehearsing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also heard Monk tell some of the guys a few things that he wanted. So I included
that's an album that, and his music obviously still lives today. Here he is in the control room at 30th Street, and that's a pretty cool shot of a console there with Monk.
Yeah.
The next picture here is from the movie that is also called Straight No Chaser, but the movie has no relation to that album. And I'm only including it here because the... another time when we did a meeting with Frank, we showed the movie Straight No Chaser, saying, here is 30th Street. But Dave Simons was looking at this and said, wait a minute, that's not 30th Street. And this picture is proof of it. You can see the ceiling up above his head, and that is definitely not the 30th Street ceiling. The movie is really great, in part because it has this wonderful picture of Frank and Tio Macero greeting Thelonious there, and also this Tio did this really great greeting of everyone that he saw at the beginning of the movie, where he would put his head down, bow, and put his one hand above his head forward and the other hand below back, and I am convinced if anybody has ever seen like the Steve Allen show in the 50s or something, I am convinced that Louis Nye or Tom Poston or something, that this was a fad, greeting movement. And I've not found any correlation for that, but I'm convinced, I know I saw it somewhere. So if anybody ever finds anything like that on a YouTube or something, let me know, because Tio does this, what, 12 or 15 times in about 3 minutes or less, yeah. Less than 3 minutes. And it's hilarious, but nobody says, what are you doing? You're crazy? It's obviously something they recognize, and Thelonious in this picture is starting to do it too. He knows the movement, so it's something that happened in that era. But that's another great movie that we've seen. And now we're in the Steve Epstein era, finally. Steve has been quiet for a long time, and I'm sorry for that, Steve, but this is one of your pictures. Why don't you talk about it?
That's right. Well, first, let me just say that it was a privilege to know Frank during my years at CBS. This picture was taken probably in 1976. We were recording the Juilliard String Quartet. And as you can see, back then we were using 67s or 87s. I never remember which one. And back then we were using four mics fairly close to the quartet and then four ambience mics. And we mixed each mic into, it might have been a four-track probably, and we would mix a close mic and a distant mic together, which was not a great idea. But in any event, you could see those speakers above the control room, and those were Altec A7s. Back then, they were also using, I believe, but you can see in the control room window, those speakers on the top hanging down. Yeah, I believe those were also A7s. And when we recorded classical, we would bring in KLH 6s, which we used for all classical recordings, not only 30th Street, but in the post-production rooms when we did the mix at 49 East 52nd Street. But the A7s were horrible speakers. Anyway.
That's an interesting contrast, though, because the A7s are horn-loaded, both low and high, and the KLHs are all direct radiator, aren't they?
They're acoustics. The KLHs were acoustic suspension speakers.
Yeah.
And we would be blowing tweeters all the time with those speakers. At some point later on, 30th Street outfitted, they got rid of the A7s and they outfitted Big Reds to take their place.
Say that again, what kind?
The Big Red speakers.
Big Red?
I think they were JBLs.
Huh.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about?
Anybody know those?
Yeah.
I'm not acquainted with those. Okay,
Dave may know. Well,
nobody said anything.
Yeah, they were, I think they were JBLs.
Oh, Tannoys, maybe? Were they?
No. They were called Big Red. They had the exterior wood was all this very bright red paint, and they were very big speakers. Yeah, you can check them out somewhere.
Okay.
But they were better sounding speakers. Nevertheless, we always used acoustic suspension speakers for classical.
Mm-hmm.
Until we got the B&W 801s in the 79-1980.
Okay.
Anyway, so yeah, that pretty much explains that picture.
And here's a session, or probably an overdub with the cello?
No, he was just, this is also the Juilliard Quartet. This was a sextet that we were recording, and he was just rehearsing there, but it was actually six string players when we finally got to the session. And one thing that I'm wondering if Frank remembers this problem. 30th Street was riddled with rumble, which was basically conducting from the floor. I guess the machines, the furnaces, whatever was downstairs would create this very low frequency rumble. And it was particularly noticeable in classical music because we would mic a little bit more distant. It was perhaps more acoustic, trying to use a little bit more of the room. And every mix that we did, when we get back to the post production, we would also have always have to use a high pass filter to eliminate it to some point. You never could fully eliminate the rumble, but it was always something that was unfortunate. And frankly, I think if the studio still existed today, the building engineers would have definitely done away with that because of digital and because of using more omnidirectional microphones for classical, et cetera.
Right.
But back then they tried to eliminate it, they just didn't succeed.
Let me ask Frank, did you notice rumble from the furnace when you were doing sessions, or your sessions maybe were too noisy for that? Although you were not a rock and roll guy.
No.
No.
But I never had any problem. The only problem with the neighbors was Roy Halley. He was in a hurry to make a name for himself. So he always worked 11 o'clock at night. And so he never gave a thought that there must be neighbors next door.
And we noticed, I pointed out earlier on the on the floor plan that there was a single wall on the east side between the studio and the building next door. So when stuff was too loud at late at night in the studio, it would bleed over into the building next door. And there was one neighbor in particular that complained.
That's what I heard.
Steve, do you know that?
Yeah, I believe so, yes. And I remember walking into the studio one day, I guess it was 1980 or so, and the east wall of the studio had been drywall had been put up there, and none of us knew about it. This was sort of done by, I guess, the chief engineer had given, you know, had asked that to be done because of the neighbor problem, and it definitely affected the acoustics of the room. We were all very unhappy about that, and I think that just remained until the studio was finally torn down, But the neighbors, I think they either called the police or there may have been a lawsuit that was started. It was just pretty serious.
Yeah, somebody.
I think that's one of the reasons the studio made its untimely demise.
Yeah, somebody. It might have been on Jim Reeves' website. Talked about looking up to see a bunch of policemen behind him, telling him to turn the sound down, in no uncertain terms. Thanks. And that's not a happy work environment.
One other thing before I forget. You see that, again, we have the 67s or 87s up to the quartet. And what I always wanted to use were C-12s. Columbia Records had an incredible amount of C-12s. They would use them mostly on the road. But the reason we couldn't use them in 30th Street is because of the proximity to the Empire State Building, which had a transmitting antenna. And therefore, the C-12s in particular were prone to RF. So it was very frustrating. However, one of the last recordings that I did at 30th Street, I said, look, let's give it a shot. Buddy Graham was the engineer. And we set up C-12s, and we moved the cables around and managed to get a very quiet result. And we ended up recording the complete Bartok quartet with Juilliard with the C-12s, and it was one of the first digital recordings. It was done directly to two-track on a 16, either a 1610 or a 1630 Sony processor. And I can't remember when the last time those C-12s would have been used in that studio.
Did you guys ever use the M49s that Frank loved so much?
I don't think we ever did, and I'm a real fan of the M49s and the M50s. But for our purposes, we never did.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how there's different fads in microphones. Fad is probably not the right word, but different microphones come in and out of favor for some ethereal reason. I don't know why, but it's interesting how times change. In that.
When you make a hit, right now.
What's that?
See, you're only aware of it when you make a hit record.
Right.
That everyone.
Everybody wants listens. To use that microphone because that's the hit microphone. Okay.
That's a picture of Buddy Graham, who is
fantastic engineer who I'd worked with for like 20 years until he retired. And he did many shows, many Broadway shows, and all most of the Cleveland Orchestra recordings, Philadelphia Orchestra recordings. He was a lot of fun, great guy.
Now, this is a picture that we had of Frank. Obviously, late in his career, with a massive console that we couldn't figure out where the heck this thing was. And then two things happened. One was through the Steve Hoffman forums, we identified it as being a CBS custom console, but didn't know where it was. And then last weekend, Steve sent me this picture here, and this is Steve.
Right, this is 30th Street. That's Stan Tockel, engineer. And that was the home-built latest, I think that was the last iteration of consoles that were used at 30th Street, if I'm not mistaken.
It had to be. It had to be because the
yeah, because
it was gone in 81, 82.
Yeah.
So this is cool. It's neat to identify that picture finally and to see that you worked, that this was your final CBS console, Frank. And it's pretty amazing. And coincidentally, also through the Steve Hoffman forums, this is one similar to it that's also a CBS custom console, but this is in the CBS Nashville studio. So it would be just a little bit different, and there's a different... Steve, what are these faders and the other ones? You told me before.
The ones in the other ones are APIs, in the other photo, API faders and API EQ.
Uh-huh. And APIs...
Yeah, they were not automated.
Yeah. And do you know what these are? Is this... This is obviously something different.
Oh, frankly, no. I don't know what that is.
Yeah. You were never in the Nashville studio, were you, Frank? Did you go to the Nashville, CBS Nashville?
Once.
Oh, okay. Did you record there or visit?
I did Ray Price.
Oh, yeah, right.
And studio engineers and setup man. Oh, just everything was so great.
All right.
So, man.
Whoa. Sorry.
Go ahead. Finish, Frank.
So the manager of the studio called me in and said, "Listen, fellas here, like what you did. Work habits, would you consider moving, come down here, steady?"
To Nashville?
Yeah.
Wow.
I said, well, I have to be very honest with you. This Southern music doesn't excite me. So I wouldn't be a good addition.
Now, you did that with a number of different kinds of music. You're not a rock and roll guy. You did a number of rock and roll songs. You did Positively 4th Street with Dylan. You did some Bird songs or somebody like that. Dave, help me here.
Well, he did Jay and the American. I remember that.
Yeah, I did that.
Okay. Was that your cup of tea?
No.
Okay.
That was a lot more noise.
Yeah.
Yeah, he referred to them as a bunch of thugs, I believe.
Oh. The clean cut Jay and the Americans? And you did Miles Davis Bitches Brew too. Which was a pretty raucous.
Yeah.
Was that your cup of tea?
that's when I pulled out of Miles Davis.
Yeah?
Well, I couldn't understand what he was trying to do using every instrument. Had to have a microphone that you could patch in and out of. So we tried so many different microphones and different inputs and outputs.
Mm-hmm. It didn't make you happy?
Not me, because I loved Miles' natural sounding trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
When he went to electric, it didn't sound that way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't appeal.
Mm.
So we had a conversation. And I said, look, I'm still your fan, and I'd like to keep working with you, but I really can't understand your style of recording with every instrument having some kind of electric pieces added to it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the way the trend goes.
That's what he said?
Mm-hmm. I agree. I said, but you asked me why I'm not happy with recording you anymore. It's because I just couldn't understand
All right, thank you for sharing that with us. I think we need to keep moving here, though. Dave, this is your turn. We're going to learn about reverb chambers. Look at this little door here.
Whose basement was that?
You've been there, I believe. This is Dave's place.
Yeah.
So, Dave, take it away.
Well, basically, after I finished doing Studio Stories, the book, and I kind of felt like Richard Dreyfuss at scene in Close Encounters, where he's piling up, doing a thing with the mashed potatoes, making like Devil's Tower, but he can't help it. And I end up in my basement one day while my wife is away for the weekend, a pile of sheetrock and some plaster, and I think I called Frank about this, told him I was going to do it, and so that weekend I finished off a wall, and when my wife was back at night, I would go downstairs with plaster and go inside this shell of an echo chamber that I had thrown together without really any know-how, and put plaster on the walls and aim, and calling Frank. I think Frank was enjoying it, and probably knowing Frank, making a few wisecracks about how maybe it will produce some echo, but will never sound anything like this, which I acknowledge. But and so that was in 2004, and it took a long time to figure out how to use it. And I talked to Frank about what kind of mic to use. I told him I couldn't spend $25,000 on a U-47. So I ended up using a Radio Shack speaker because it was small. And the thing, because this chamber is so small, I couldn't put a lot of things in there that would actually soak up whatever echo was there. So
So I just use the Radio Shack speaker, and I end up settling on a Sennheiser 421, a dynamic mic, unlike the condenser mic that Frank used. Now I'm actually standing right outside the chamber right now. I'm going to stick my head inside, and I want to see if you guys can hear this, but it sounds like.
All right.
Can you hear that?
All
that's
right.
My desk, the chamber. I just stuck my head in there. And yeah. It sounds a lot better when you send a signal in there because it's all closed up.
Well, we have those examples that we can play. Bob, let's do the flute one first. This is the dry. Well, that was for effect. Yeah, you're getting a critique on your mixing there, Dave.
Oh, I'm sure. I was ready for that.
Now, we have one more piece from your chamber, and then we've got some of the 30th Street and 799. So,
that's unfair.
Well, tell us again how big this is before we listen to this piece.
The chamber is 15 feet long and about 7.5 or 8 feet high, but it's only 3 feet wide because I didn't want my wife to know that I built a chamber at the end of the back of the basement. So, although what you're going to hear next is actually my wife singing. And I believe this was the first thing that she... I do record my wife occasionally, and this was the first time that she actually heard the chamber, and she actually really, really liked it. And this was recorded, you know, you'll notice that on that Tony Bennett film you saw, you could hear that Frank would always... He would never add echo. He recorded with it. And so this was an experiment that I did in which I recorded my wife and with the chamber rather than adding the effect afterwards like you just heard.
Okay, go ahead, Bob. First heard that sounded like the Shirelles, very similar, or the Shangri-Las. I mean, Shangri-Las.
Yeah, that was kind of the idea.
Yeah. So now let's listen to another comparison that Dave put together. And this, tell us, Dave, what this is again. This is the Tony Bennett one, the first piece.
Right.
Bob, do you have
first piece?
Go ahead, Dave.
I believe the first one is going to be. I think. This is all I ask. Is that the first one that's on there? And if it is, I believe at one point Frank and I talked about this, that Ernie Ochsler, who was one of the producers at the time, I think Frank confirmed this, really, really liked a lot of echo. And this is almost as much echo as you hear coming out of the 30th Street chamber. Right, Frank? I mean, this is pretty intense. This is what I'm thinking.
We're going to hear a lot of echo here, right, Frank? Well, he doesn't know. He hasn't heard it. So go ahead and play, Bob.
As I approach the prime of my life, I find I have the time of my life, learning to enjoy at my leisure all the simple pleasures. And so I happily concede that this is all I ask. This is all I need. Beautiful girls, walk a little slower when you walk by me.
And then this next one is?
I believe this next one is also If I Love Again, which is more of the kind of echo that we're used to. But this is now like, this is 1962. And I really love the way the sound that Frank got out of this one in particular. Just the blend, the instrument, you know, Ralph Shannon's piano is nice and dry and crisp. And but in the contrast with the just nice moderate amount of echo that Frank put on it, it's just such a beautiful, makes a real beautiful dynamic contrast.
Okay.
I often wonder why you came to me, brought such a flame to me, then let it die. And if another love should find my heart, it will remind my heart of your goodbye. With every new love, you'll come back to me in other eyes. It's you I'll see. If I love again, though it's someone new. If I love again, it will still.
Last one is San Francisco, I think.
It is, and the interesting thing about this one is, and again, we've talked about this, Frank. What makes this kind of unique is that, and earlier when you were just talking about songs being sent off to the Seventh Ave studio to be remixed, and this one apparently, Mike Figlio, I believe, Frank, if I'm correct, was the remix engineer, and he had already had some echo on Tony's voice, of course, which Frank would do, but he made the decision to add even more, and at that studio on 7th Ave, they had an echo chamber, which was actually a stairwell that ran the length of the building. I believe it was about six flights, and they had a speaker way down the bottom and a microphone at the top or vice versa, and he added this distinct sheen to Tony's voice on this song, and you can really hear the difference between the echo we just heard. This one is a little more trebly, and you can hear the consonants really kind of, you know, accentuated, and it's a very unique sound.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay. The glory that was Rome is of another day. I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm going home to my city by the bay.
I left my heart in San Francisco. High on a hill, it calls to me.
Yeah, you can definitely hear the very different spectral balance. It's much more toppy, as you said, than
absolutely
those other ones.
Yeah,
interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and I just got to say one thing really quickly, that What an absolute honor and thrill it is to look at my echo chamber, which is basically a shrine to Frank Laco, while you were playing that music. And I'm wondering if Frank's echo chamber has as much mold in it as mine does, looking at this photo. Thank you, Frank.
Well, I thought it would be nice to show this while you were playing those tracks,
tears in my eye.
The good thing that you played San Francisco is because that was one of the few that Frank produced, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Quickly tell us how that happened, because Mitch was the producer for that session and was credited for it.
Yes, we were scheduled. Start 11 o'clock at night, and Mitch was gung-ho. He wanted to do San Francisco. So he said, okay, let's do San Francisco. Silence. So then they talked about a second. Didn't go over. So at this point, Mitch was very agitated. He said, I won't use the language. But I said, he's surprised that Mitch used that kind of language. He was so upset. About a quarter to 11, he leans over. Okay, Frank, you take over. You produce San Francisco. I laughed. I said, thank you, I appreciate that. But what do you expect me to do that you haven't done? Interesting to hear what you did do, as long as I. So he did. I thought did a good job. It was clean, no real echo sound, but very pure singing.
So you didn't have echo in it when you recorded it?
No, I had some.
Some, yeah. And it turned out pretty well.
Yeah, and then that's when I made more changes.
Mm.
At first in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got to the studio, just to hear what they would say. And all of them were favorable. So I thought to God, if the record industry is that bad that 3-4 people listen to a tune, tear it apart, and then consider as a recorded session.
Mm-hmm.
person. I have a few others if you want to listen. Oh, yes. It's here. So I'd get a couple more. And the last one I did.
Cover your tracks.
Took me a long time to learn that.
Yeah.
But anyhow, they finally agreed to what I had created was good. So they played it at a sales meeting, which they would do every week. Long, I had opened my mouth, and I could see everyone shaking their heads. He's doing it again. He never learns. So okay, I listened to all that. Then I decided that I. Stick to my version of my idea.
Okay.
That was a sneeze.
Okay. So you played it for the record, guys, and you were going to stick to yours.
Yeah, so came day of the meeting. I don't know who chose the music for that period. But of the six different tunes, know what they were talking about.
So were they there to choose the song to push? Or and did they choose San Francisco?
No, I think Mitch made the decision.
But somebody chose it and it became a big hit, a huge hit. That's Tony's signature song.
Yeah.
And you did it. All right.
Yeah, it was late at night.
Yeah.
And he and Mitch were barking at each other.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, thank you. And good night. I wanted to make sure he wasn't hanging around.
Mitch.
Just to show me something.
Right.
Did the first tune, and Tony, about 2 minutes in, said, I like it, that's a great one. I don't think we have to do anymore. So Big Frank. bitter on you.
Mm-hmm.
I suggest you do another couple tunes or versions.
Mm-hmm. Of the same song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what we did when I got finished. Then I said, well, now we'll play it back. And I said, I kept the notation, whatever change I made, it's here. To listen in this period. Well, sure, we should hear it. Otherwise, it wastes time.
Mm-hmm. So, was it the third take that was the one, was the keeper? Do you remember?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you made him do it three times. He didn't want to do it at all. And you made him do it three times, and the third one was the one.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was great. That's how history is made.
Well, you're right about that. But my association with Tony was something that was bound. You couldn't change it if you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So we continued all these years and never thought to turn around and check again. So we never did. We just kept making hit record after hit record.
And he called you when he was in town the last time, right?
Well, he was in...
When he was in Seattle last time?
No, he was in... Vegas.
Vegas, okay. He called you from there? Oh, that was cool.
Late at night.
Uh-huh.
Oh, sure. Hi, Tony. Good, good. What is there anything you want me to do? Let me know. What do you have to do?
Oh, neat.
That he mixed.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. That's great.
So I said, good. So I said, you listen, tell me what you think.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, Frank, speaking of late night, it's getting to be pretty late now.
Yeah, it is.
So we need to wrap this up here. And, I've got a slide on the screen now saying that, again, crediting Don Hunstein for most of the in-studio photos, along with Steve Epstein, who provided some. The videos that we saw, Glenn Gould, On and Off the Record, these are all much longer videos that were edited down just to show the 30th Street studio part. They're available widely. I want to thank everybody here for attending. And want to offer special thanks to Dave Campbell, the Krista Center, Rick Chin, Roxanne Hellerin for having us here, Steve Hoffman Forums, Gary Louie, Matt Lutens, Lars Nefsker, Jim Reeves, Bob Smith, Matt Stearns, Mark Wilder, and everybody else who helped with this project. And especially to David Simons, Stephen Epstein, Colette Lako, and Frank Lako, Control Man, CBS Records.
Hey, that's some response, Colette. just makes me think I've been wasting a lot of time that I haven't let you go to work.
No. Yep, that's true.
So from now on, when I hear something I think you can do, I'll let you hear it. might as well record you and reap whatever money might come.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Frank, and thank you, everyone. And I think we need to end this. End it tonight. It's pretty late. We need to get out of here. This is a quiet place. So let's get the lights there, please. And thank you again, everybody.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Thanks for the memory of things I can't forget. Journeys.